American Idol starts its third season on Monday, and once again we'll be treated to some awful singing by people who think they're quite talented. And we'll hear the blunt, some would say cruel, criticisms of the show's most controversial judge, Simon Cowell. He's not just a judge, he co-created the Idol phenomenon, which started with the British TV show Pop Idol. Cowell has been in the music industry most of his adult life and is now an executive at BMG Records. Last season, the winner of American Idol was Reuben Studdard, and the runner-up was Clay Aiken. They've both released records, which became hits. Let's start with a track from Reuben Studdard's album Soulful. This is his version of the Carpenters' hit Superstar.
Long ago, and oh, so far away, the second show.
Welcome to Fresh Air. When American Idol started, or let's get back to when Pop Idol started, the British version, did you know right away that you were going to, as a judge, be rude or totally honest, depending on how you want to look at it? But did you know that that's what your persona was going to be?
I didn't really think about it too much, actually, Terry. I got so caught up in the development of the show in the UK, I hadn't really given my role too much thought. And in fact, when we started auditioning the very first day on the very first British show, it was just terrible because we all kind of got camera fright and became very polite. So the first hour of TV was just atrocious. And in the end, I had to take out one of my fellow judges out the room and say, this is just awful because I'm just dying in there because all the things I want to say, I'm not saying, so I think we should just behave as we would in a normal audition and walk back in the room, and from that moment on, it all changed.
Well, no, wait a minute. At a normal audition, do you speak that honestly to the person who's auditioning, or is that how you talk after they leave the room?
If I'm being honest, we're worse, because in a normal audition, someone will open the door and will just say leave before they even start.
Oh, really? Why, based on their hair or something?
Yeah, just on the way they look on everything. You just know. If you're auditioning for something specific and somebody walks in who you know is just not suitable, I mean, it's like the door opens, leave. You could argue that perhaps, you know, in real life auditions, people are treated a little bit more harshly.
Now, on American Idol, you've seen a lot of very bad singers. What do you think makes bad singers think that they're good?
Oh, God. I wish I could explain that. I can't answer that, but I can, I think, answer why these people enter a competition like American Idol. Because I think today, more than any other time in history, we live in what I call a fame epidemic. Whereas when I was at school, I'm 44, when you asked people in my class what you wanted to be when you left school, most of the girls would reply nurse, and most of the boys would reply racing driver or train driver. Ask that same question today, and I think most of the replies would be famous. And I think that's partly because of just the type of magazines which are popular at the moment. They are broadcasting the type of lives you could have if you become famous. And it's just to encourage everybody now to chase that dream.
Boy, you're really feeding into that, though, aren't you, with American Idol? Particularly, like, there's videos in it where all of the contestants talk about what it's like to ride in a limo and to get the makeover and to have somebody do your makeup and to sign autographs. And it's like, oh, boy, maybe I'll be famous, too, one day.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but I think the show works because, in other words, one feeds off the other at the moment, I think, Terry. I love the idea of giving somebody 15 minutes of fame and actually taking it away. I do. I love it.
Why do you like the taking it away part?
I don't know. I'm just quite sadistic, really, Terry.
It sounds that way, actually.
But that's, you know, that, of course, we are giving them the ultimate torture, as you quite rightly say. We put them in the mansion and we give them the limousine, and their fate now is determined by somebody picking up the telephone or not picking up the telephone. But it's sort of like a delicious thrill, isn't it?
One of the things I found very interesting about watching American Idol is that, in a way, it's a catalog of all the bad mannerisms that have seeped into pop music. Like, if you watch the show enough, you can see all of the things that have gone wrong in pop music that people are picking up on and trying to emulate.
Mm-hmm.
For example, like that kind of melisma where you're singing around the note and up and down and around the note and embellishing a lot without doing a good job of it, without really adding anything, and it becomes really annoying. It just becomes pure mannerism. There's a lot of that on the radio. There was a lot of that in American Idol, too.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel that way, that you're watching this kind of catalog of things that have gone wrong in pop music?
100%. Because like you, Terry, I loathe that kind of singing. Because for me, when you listen to some of the great singers like Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, you know, these guys never sang like that, but they were just amazing singers. It's almost an affectation now, because you're not supposed to sing like that. I absolutely loathe it. But I was talking to the girl who brought me down from the publishing house earlier on, just basically saying, which we both said, how much we dislike music on the radio at the moment because it's so monotonous.
I just want to make it clear that I don't think all singing around the note is bad. It's just that there's a certain kind of pointless embellishment that's really
annoying. Look, it's like people coming in, Terry, where they try and copy an artist so accurately that they even sing the ad-libs.
Right, right.
And you try and explain what an ad-lib is. You know, it's not part of the song, it's an ad-lib. And they do it in their audition. I mean, it drives me nuts. There aren't too many Frank Sinatras or Ella Fitzgeralds around at the moment to copy. They are copying bad singers in the first place. And, of course, it becomes like some ghastly Xerox machine, you know. The original isn't very good, and the copies are even worse. But, you know, Terry, look, if I'm being honest with you, the show works because of its imperfections.
Right.
If it was a perfect show, it would be boring.
How much of a say do the singers have in which songs they do?
It is totally down to them. I mean, you know, Terry, we could sit there week on week really helping them with their choice of songs, choice of arrangements, what they wear. But the fun, as the show continues, is watching the contestants getting it right and, of course, watching it get them wrong. For instance, when Clay sang that ghastly version of Grease on American Idol 2 and came running out in that awful red leather jacket, you just think, what are you doing? But that's, again, you know, the appeal of the show is that some weeks they get it right and often they get it wrong.
You know, American Idol is really just like an incredible marketing machine. You know, you put the people on TV. By the time the series is over, the person who wins is a star. Then they make the record. So there's already an audience waiting for the record before the record's even released. And then after the first season, there was the movie. Now there, you
don't
know,
mention it.
What's that? Don't mention it. That was the big failure, wasn't it?
Yeah. God almighty. But the funny thing was, I remember when the producer told me the name of the film, and he said it's called From Justin to Kelly. I said, have you ever heard of a director called Ed Wood? And he said, no. And I said, well, it sounds like the title of one of his films, because it sounds like a transvestite movie from Justin to Kelly. He didn't get the joke. And it ended up looking like an Ed Wood movie. Big mistake.
Well, couldn't you have stopped it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, there are certain people who, you know, who are involved with the artists who can do what the hell they want. I mean, I can hold my hand up as the record label and say, big mistake here, guys. But, you know, they learn their lessons.
Now, you have a management company that manages the people on American Idol.
No, I'm the record label.
Oh, you don't do the management too?
No, there's two Simons, myself and Simon Fuller.
Oh.
And we created the show together. And he has the television rights and the management rights. And I have the recording rights.
I see. So when they make a record, that's your thing, and the management is his. So
correct.
How long does he get to manage them? Like, how long does the contract say they're under his management when they do American Idol?
My guess is it probably runs about the same length as the recording contract, which normally would run anywhere between 3 and 7 years, depending on how many options you want to pick up.
Oh, so like Kelly Clarkson and Clay Aiken and Ruben Studdard are all contracted to you for how many, 3 to 7 years, did you say?
We normally have an option to release up to 5 albums.
Right.
And in every year, you decide whether you're going to pick your option up to make another album or not.
Are you buddies with them, or?
No, not at all.
Uh-huh.
Not at all. If I see them, you know, I spend a bit of time with them, but I've got to be honest with you, I've never really been what I would call buddies with any of my artists, because it doesn't work. I feel there has to be a separation.
Now, early in your career as a record producer, you know how to market things. You called the World Wrestling Foundation and suggested you do an album with you know, Randy Macho Man Savage and some of the other WWF guys, not because they were great singers, but because they had an audience who would buy their products. So you had a built-in market.
Yes. Yeah. It was just common sense. They'd come over to the UK.
Let me just say, it's the World Wrestling Federation, not Foundation.
Federation, yeah. You're absolutely right.
It sounds like a non-profit organization the way I said it.
Believe me, that's not. they came over to London, and I read in one of our newspapers that they'd sold out 82,000 seats in 27 minutes. Oh, hang on a minute, there's not a rock band in the world who can do that. And I also found out that they were selling about 2.5 million videos a year to the fans who watched the show. So it didn't take a lot of time to realize that if they were selling that many seats and that many videos, that there would be a lot of kids who'd want to buy an album from the wrestlers as well. It was just common sense.
But did it ever make you think, but I'm not being true to my musical love. I'm just doing this as pure marketing.
What do you think, Terry?
Give me the money.
Give me the money. And you know, it's a funny thing about the music industry, which I think it's quite unusual, because I think in television and film, it's readily accepted that both TV and film has to survive as an industry by selling to all sorts of demographics. I mean, you have children's TV, you have more serious TV, you have mass market TV. My theory about the music industry is that why shouldn't we run the record label with that concept, which is, of course, you can have the more credible, serious stuff, but why shouldn't a younger audience be able to buy music they like, which isn't necessarily the most artistic form on earth, but they love when they buy it? I mean, I've never seen the sense of being snobbish about music. You either like it or you don't.
So there's versions of American Idol now in 21 countries. What are some of the most interesting differences between what the singers in each of those countries are like? You know, how they perform, what their mannerisms are, what really irks you about them?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Nothing changes all over the world, Terry. You know, it's if you took away, you know, the talking part, it's really difficult, probably with the exception of Lebanon, which is fairly ghastly, Lebanon Idol. I mean, that's almost a contradiction in terms, isn't it? But It's no, that's why I think the show works as a universal show, which is that the same rules apply. Most of the people who turn up are terrible. Every single person believes they are God's gift to the music industry. So they are the same.
Does every country cover Stevie Wonder records?
Yes. Every country now. The funny thing was is that we, you know, as you know, started the show in England. And then when we sold it all over the world, every country tried to find somebody unpleasant on the judging panel. And
right.
that's quite bizarre. People who I've known for years as jolly nice people suddenly turning into complete pigs. and that's quite irritating.
Everyone who watches the show knows that part of the drama of American Idol is the tension between you and one of the other judges, Paula Abdul, who was a pop star in the 80s. And her persona on the show as a judge is somebody who's always supportive. Even if she hates the singer, she'll find something nice and encouraging to say to them. And you're just the opposite. If something bothers you, you'll just bluntly say it. So you argue with each other on the show, and there's a whole constellation of jokes about your relationship. Did you know things would be like that? Because after you must have been in on hiring her in the first place, you created the show.
Well, when it was decided to hire Paula, you know, we all had a hand in the decision, and I only knew of her as a pop star, and I only met her for the first time when I walked into the audition room on that first day in Los Angeles, and I was introduced to her 20 or 30 minutes before the show started. It was Paula who, you know, kind of reacted strangely within the first hour of auditioning, because I don't think she quite knew what the show was going to be like. And I guess she thought we were all going to be like the people on Star Search and tell everybody they're great. And after the first three or four auditions, I mean, she, you know, she was horrified, really horrified. And that did create a lot of tension.
When Paula Abdul became a judge on the show, did you feel like saying to some of the contestants on the show, this is what happens to pop stars 10, 20 years later, people don't know who they are anymore?
God, that's a good point. No, I didn't actually, but now you mentioned it, I think I might mention it. I.e., don't enter, this is what happens. But you know what, funny enough, Terry, at the end of the day, I actually do like Paula, and because, you know, she's actually got a much, much harder job than I've got. It's easy for me to criticize all these people and to be rude. I would find it really hard to do what she does week after week, which is to try and see, you know, the bright side of things. I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Simon Cowell of American Idol is my guest. He has a new book called I Don't Mean to Be Rude, But... a few months ago, you introduced a new program, American Juniors, which is...
I didn't.
You don't have anything to do with that?
I'm saying that quickly, no.
Oh, I thought it was part of the same franchise,
no,
so to speak.
Absolutely not.
Oh. What do you think of it?
Dreadful.
Why?
Absolutely dreadful.
Uh-huh.
Well, what's the point? I mean, no one at the age of 11 can really sing. There's nothing you can say to them because you can't criticize a 10 or 11-year-old. The whole thing was just ghastly. I didn't want anything to do with it.
Were you offered the chance?
Yeah. Not as a judge, but as an executive producer.
So how much of this is just like aesthetics, and how much of it is like moral, that it's not right to put young people through something like this, like kids through something like this?
Well, I have a problem with that. I really do. I even have a problem with people entering our show at the age of 16 now, because they're just not ready for it. I mean, I go into this show as a grown-up, and I like to treat people like grown-ups, and I find it very difficult sometimes saying to a 16-year-old, you know what I really think, because they're just, in my opinion, not mature enough to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't
mm-hmm.
think it benefits anybody,
mm-hmm.
Me, them, the audience at home. They're just too young, you know. They've got to be of an age to deal with this, I think, because the music industry, you know, I mean, look at Michael Jackson, you know. You take someone in at an early age, and you see what happens. I mean, you lose your growing up period. And this is what happens when you go into the music industry at such an early age. Now, you say that to an 11-year-old, they're never going to listen to you, because once again, they want to be rich and famous. But when you deprive someone of that age, of their normal growing up, you really can do them serious damage, in my opinion.
You come from a pretty privileged background. You grew up on an estate with a staff north of London. Your father was in real estate. He was the head of properties for the record publishing company, EMI. So, you know, you grew up in fine surroundings. So does that help you understand, or does it not help you understand the drive for money that people have who don't come from that kind of background?
Well, even though my parents had money, I'd say 90% or 95% of the people who are my friends or who I grew up around were self-made. Everything they achieved, they did themselves. And we were always encouraged, myself and my brothers, that if we were going to earn money, no one was going to give it to us. We had to earn it ourselves, and we had to start, you know, literally from the bottom. And that was kind of drummed into me from a really early age. I mean, when I joined EMI, I could have joined in a sort of a senior management position, even at the age of 17, but decided to take a job in the mailroom for 2 years so I could work it out for myself. The only difference, I suppose, was is that growing up, I could see what money could buy you if you had it. So I was quite keen to have some myself.
One more question. When a performer is doing what you consider to be a really bad job, you often accuse them of being like performing like they should be at Six Flags or some other like theme park or amusement park. And but in some way, the type of pop singing that's done on American Idol seems to be the type of pop singing that would flourish at those parks but not have a home in a lot of other places. You know, the clubs that teenagers and college students go to don't have that kind of pop. And, you know, the expensive clubs like in Vegas have older performers. I know you've created venues for them, but was there a pre-existing venue for that type of pop of people that age?
Probably not, no. I take the point you're saying, Terry, which is that you look as if you're contradicting yourself sometimes. The problem we had was simply this, is that if we had decided to bring in rap music and hip-hop music, I actually don't believe anybody would have watched this show. The only time we feel that we can keep an audience is when they are singing older songs in an older style. And you'll notice that all the people who've won this competition have never varied from that. I mean, one of our better singers, Tamyra Gray, she veered off slightly one week by singing something a bit more contemporary. And she was voted off the show.
Why is that, do you think?
Because I honestly don't know. I think you could argue one of the reasons is because there is an older audience watching.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also say that even the younger kids who are watching, even though they don't like to admit it, they actually do like traditional old pop songs.
You know what I think it is, too? You take something like hip-hop. You're supposed to have a certain, like, street cred or authenticity or something. And you're certainly not going to get street cred or authenticity by being on American Idol.
Listen, you've hit the nail on the head. And, you know, we had this supposed rocker on the show last year. His name was Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
But he was somebody who looked like he'd gone into the rock shop and said, make me a rock star. I mean, he just wasn't believable. And I described him as being a sheep in wolf's clothing and made the point, because when he said to me, I'm into rock and roll, I said, no, you're not, mate, because rock and roll is anti-establishment. This is establishment, this show. So just by the fact that you bothered to audition, you've told me very, very loud and clear, you are not rock and roll. But it's exactly the point you just made. You know, if you really are into that kind of music, you stay away from a show like American Idol.
Where are you now in the production of the next season of American Idol?
Well, we have shot all the audition shows, and I know who our finalists are, or our 36. And I have to tell you, Terry, these are some of the worst audition shows you will ever see in your life.
Does it keep getting worse? Does it get better or worse as the show gets more and more of a reputation?
After American Idol 2, I didn't think it would get any worse than this. And then we went to Houston. And that was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Simon Cowell, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed talking to you, Terry.
Simon Cowell has a new book called I Don't Mean to Be Rude, But... The third season of American Idol begins Monday. We'll close with a track from last season's runner-up, Clay Aiken. I'm Terry Gross.
Ooh, what you doing tonight? I wish I could be a fly on your wall.